My name is Paul Kearney, and this is Policymaking in the UK, week three. I'm calling this one, Do You Really Know Who Is in Charge and Who to Blame? Now, this might sound very much like week two, but go with it. It's good repetition, it's not bad. So this week, we'll continue with the idea of two stories of British politics. So you've got one, which is the one associated with the Westminster model. Your sort of key moral is if you have the centralisation of power, it produces clear lines of accountability. You know who's in charge and who the heroes or villains are. We're contrasting that with complex government story in which the world seems too messy and power seems too spread amongst too many actors to even know who the main characters are, or all of them at least. Now, in this week, what I'm suggesting is some aspects of these stories are specific to the UK and British politics, but the sort of things we'll talk about this week are what I would call universal questions and concepts. They can apply, most of them apply, any time, any place, anywhere. Okay. And they raise, I think, in three different ways, some unrealistic expectations associated with the Westminster story when we talk about them in some depth. So to explain that, we'll break that down into three types of assumption that you might associate with this Westminster story. The first is, you know what government policy is, and you know it's made by a small number of actors at the heart of government. The second is, those actors possess, something akin to comprehensive knowledge about the problems they are trying to solve and the solutions they describe. The third thing is they can turn those policy solutions or intentions into outcomes in a straightforward way. And none of these things are true, okay? And we can explain that with reference to the kinds of concepts you would find in any public policy course. Okay, so the first is you don't know what policy is, and it's not only made by a small number of actors at the heart of government. So have a look at some of the other posts. Have a look at that What is Policy post. Because it's designed there to say how hard it is even to define what public policy is. So I like a definition that's the sum total of government action from signals of intent to final outcomes. Not because it's a good definition, but because it raises lots more issues. So for example, when you get into these definitions, you find that it's remarkably difficult to say what policy is, to come up with a small number of manageable instruments that sum it up, and measure how much it changes. When you try to do so, you often find it's made by many actors, not just a small group, but many actors inside government, outside government, and organisations which seem to be both inside and outside government. Then, when you look at things like networks, you find that the sort of boundary between who makes policy and who influences it is very fluid. And we tend to talk about policy being made by collectivities rather than individuals. And of course, a classic discussion of the study of power in politics is to say that policy is often about the things governments don't do, for various reasons. So look up that in some detail. The second thing is that actors don't possess this comprehensive knowledge about problems and solutions. So, I mean, as a basic point, that's fairly obvious. No one could possibly possess all information relevant to policy. But it's not obvious what happens next. And, this basic insight associated with the phrase bounded rationality has led to a whole host of concepts and explanations about what happens next. Now, the sort of classic post-war discussions are associated with Herbert Simon and Charles Lindbloom. Now, Simon would talk about this idea of satisficing or producing good enough decisions based on identifying goals and deciding based on, limited but good knowledge and, the maximisation of people's cognitive ability. So you do something good enough while recognising your limits. But Lindblom had a sort of different emphasis, and one emphasis was that there are other measures of good policy beyond, based on knowledge alone. And one of them was that, you know, good policy is based on widespread consensus between groups. Now have a look at that, because one implication was a way to deal with limitations to rationality were to limit the discussed options to a small number of options which are represent incremental steps from the status quo, no radical departures away from it. Because if you have this widespread consensus, why would you ride roughshod over those policies? Now, the implication is if you're only considering a small number of options and or incremental steps, that is a good way of dealing with the limits to your ability to gather and process information. So if you think about it there, it has this descriptive element about the limits to government abilities and starts talking about the more sort of normative elements about what you should do about it. Now, more modern discussions offer us different implications, different empirical studies, and there's a whole raft of them on that 1,000 words page. But I think there are three that are, for our purposes, are worth focusing on in the most depth. The first insight is that, you know, policymakers deal with their bounded rationality by only paying disproportionate attention to a tiny proportion of the issues for which they are ostensibly responsible. Now, that produces two things. One is this great potential for so-called punctuations in policy and policymaking. If attention suddenly lurches to an area and it's disproportionate attention, you might expect a period of instability in, you know, government relationships with groups, and you might expect some policy change after that attention. But at the same time, there's a logical consequence of this lurch and a concentration of attention in one area is that there's no or minimal attention paid in almost every other area. So what happens then? Your policy tends to be made in networks or communities at a relatively low level of government in the absence of high-level ministerial attention. So that's the first big implication there. And think about how that relates to our idea of, you know, Westminster central control. You can identify control if you focus on that small number of issues in which they pay high attention. But you would not identify the same level or the same sense of control if you looked at all of those other areas in which they pay no attention. The second insight is that even in areas where policymakers pay disproportionate attention, they have to combine rational and irrational ways to make decisions with, you know, in a short amount of time with limited information. So they frame problems in a particular way to limit their attention to a small number of solutions. And irrational, I mean, it's not an accurate description, but it describes a tendency to make shortcuts to information using emotional decision-making or gut-level decision-making based on, you know, deeply held beliefs or moral choices. And then, you know, backed up by a selective use of supportive evidence. So have a look at, you know, the post on framing, and have a look at this, the sort of post on the social construction of target populations. You know, governments often try to solve problems quickly by characterising populations quickly and then acting as a result. Now, the third insight is that it's always difficult to describe this process as evidence-based policymaking, even when policymakers have sincere intentions. You know, so sometimes we talk about policy-based evidence when there's a sort of egregious attempt to, you know, subvert, you know, the principles of good policymaking. But even if they were sincere, they would face these limits of attention and cognitive ability, which would mean they would always have to make compromises, you know, to satisfy their need to act quickly and to satisfy principles in politics that are not simply about gathering good evidence. So the third point is policymakers cannot turn policy intent into outcomes in a straightforward way. So the classic way to describe this sort of straightforward process is to identify policy cycles with discrete stages. You know, you start off with identifying a problem, make a decision, legitimize that decision, implement, evaluate, and then think about if you should keep going or do something else. Now, that is a classic way to describe policymaking, but largely to say what doesn't happen. Now, it describes a kind of good-looking way to make policy, but life isn't simple enough for it to happen. So instead, really what we're trying to do is consider what happens in the real world instead of these cycles. Now, one thing we would focus on is trying to explain or identify a gap between the expectations of policymakers, based on the policies they make, and the actual outcomes, which are often dispiriting when, their choices are not reflected in what happens next. Now, this is when our previous discussion of King Canute comes in handy, because sometimes we're analysing the sort of concern of policymakers that they wanted something to happen and it didn't. But we can also study cases in which policymakers did not really have those high expectations. They measure success in different ways, and only one of them relates to these long-term policy outcomes. Often they would describe their success in terms of, how popular a policy choice makes them, or how easy it was to get through Parliament, or something like that. So, there's not necessarily, when we talk about an implementation gap, it's not necessarily caused by, complexity in policymaking. It's often caused by, low expectations of policymakers themselves, or vague expectations of policymakers. And these kinds of discussions were popular long before we started talking about multi-level governance, in which there were far more actors involved in making policy. And this was often a deliberate strategy of the UK central government to spread responsibility, across different levels of government. So you've got two different discussions there. One is we now have this formal separation of powers across many governments. The other is to say that even when policy was notionally centralised, you still had these implementation gaps. Now, the upshot of all that is that, even in these Westminster systems in which we tell a story about centralised control, it's really not that easy to identify who is in charge and who is to blame. Instead, we have this sense of more complex government in which it's difficult to identify government policy, link it to a rational process associated with, gathering evidence and making choices at the heart of government, and tracing a line from those choices to outcomes. Now, I wouldn't go too far and to say that, government is too complex to identify any heroes or villains, but we would just say that we should not assume that the policy process works like that. Now, we'll go into some of these issues in the seminar questions. So, what I'll do is first ask you just to summarize the main points of this post, because it looks pretty simple, but there's a lot of further reading there. Then I want to get into some examples of British politics. So come prepared to answer these three questions. What is government policy in an example you choose? How did the government choose that policy? How can you trace a process in which they did it through a relatively rational set of procedures? And what were the outcomes? Can you identify a link between their choices and the outcomes?